Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Ellerbuck. Counsel of Defense, you may proceed.
May it please the Court, I'm Captain Barbara Snow-Martone, and along with Colonel Mark Teletochi, we represent PFC Ellerbrock. In contrast to the Court of Military Appeals decisions in United States v. Dorsey and United States v. Williams, the Banker Court has not only emphasized use of MRE 412's balancing test, it has increased the burden to an accused in the application of that balancing test. In requiring that proffered evidence not only be relevant and material, but also vital, Banker has increased the quantum of proof not recognized by its higher court in Washington v. Texas and United States v. Valenzuela-Bernal. In Washington v. Texas, the court noted that the excluded evidence was relevant, material, and vital to the defense. However, in its holding, the Washington court focused on the relevance and materiality of the excluded evidence in concluding that the petitioner in that case was denied his right to compulsory process for obtaining witnesses. The term vital as used in Washington pertained not to a required evidentiary showing, but rather acted to emphasize just how relevant and material the evidence sought to be admitted in that particular case was. Likewise, the court in United States v. Valenzuela-Bernal spoke of a defendant's needing to at least make some plausible showing that proffered evidence is both material and favorable to his defense. In other words, a defendant had to show that material and relevant evidence was actually favorable to his defense. The Banker's court's interpretation of favorable to mean vital.
So essentially anything the defendant offers is fair game because they're obviously going to offer anything, only things that are favorable. So if they pass a relevance test, it's in.
No, Your Honor. Consistent with the two U.S. Supreme Court cases I just cited, the evidence has to be relevant and material. What's important to
and
keep in
mind. Congress cannot impose any restrictions on that.
Restrictions.
If it passes 401, 402, it's in.
That's not what I'm arguing, Your Honor. 412, the balancing test, you need to show that it's relevant and material, again, consistent with those U.S. Supreme Court.
But I hear your brief says full stop. Then it's in, no matter what.
To the extent our brief is inconsistent with my argument today, sir, I'd like you to consider what I'm saying today, and that's it needs to be material and, relevant and material.
Period or more? Full stop or?
It's not a full stop to the extent you have to do the balancing test.
So you are arguing then you proceed to a balance.
That's correct.
Oh, okay, because that's different than your brief. Your
correct,
brief just said, stop there, thank you, I'm done.
No, okay. Because we recognize that there are legitimate government interests, particularly the privacy interests of the alleged victim. Does that sufficiently answer your question, Your Honor?
It does, thank you.
Banker's court's interpretation of favorable to mean vital places a rational basis of MRE 412's balancing test in jeopardy. Under the rational basis test, exclusion of evidence must not be arbitrary or disproportionate to the purposes its exclusion was designed to serve. And that is language coming from Michigan versus Lucas. And permitting only vital defense evidence to outweigh the danger of unfair prejudice to an alleged victim's privacy interest, the Banker decision facilitates exclusion of plausibly exculpatory evidence to include evidence that a witness has fabricated sexual assault allegations. Banker's vital requirement burdens an accused who, even after showing his evidence relevant and material, must nonetheless still show that evidence is vital. Absent any such showing, Banker presumes an alleged victim's privacy interests trump an accused's constitutional right to confront witnesses, even, if you will, in the absence of supporting government evidence.
What about a case like this? Can the actions of the prosecutrix affect the privacy interest? As a case like this where she talked about it and said she didn't mind talking about it, although she then said she didn't want it brought up at the trial.
Your Honor, those facts are definitely consistent with the facts of this case.
I'm asking a question. Does that undercut the privacy interest?
Absolutely, it does, Your Honor. So that's what we're speaking of. Not only
and you balance that. That goes into the NEO 403 balancing.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
In applying Banker's balancing test in this case, the military judge prevented appellant from offering the plausibly exculpatory evidence that the alleged victim fabricated her rape and sodomy allegations against him to protect her marriage.
Why is her affair with someone from 3 years earlier exculpatory?
It was exculpatory because it went to her motive to fabricate. As a result of that extramarital affair, her husband had a volatile emotional reaction, which for a temporary period of time anyway, jeopardized the marriage.
Is the theory of relevance reaction, or is the theory of relevance affair?
It's both, Your Honor. They go hand in hand.
And would you expect, so is the theory that she has a motive to fabricate focus on reaction? She has a motive to fabricate because her husband is hot-tempered and will react.
Will react.
Fair enough. And so the theory is that he is hot-tempered and will react to her on consensual sex, but not to someone raping his wife.
That's correct.
That would not cause the same reaction because that would not cause him to be angry.
It could, but what's missing, Your Honor, if I may, is his reaction and the effect that reaction would have on the marriage.
And where in the record is there evidence or information that indicates anybody was concerned about the effect this would have on the marriage?
Absolutely. Upon an initial questioning...
From her perspective,
yes, Your Honor. At the 412 motion hearing, she was asked whether or not she was concerned that her husband would leave her as a result of this extramarital affair. Her initial response, without any direction...
What are you talking about?
The alleged victim's first response.
Okay.
When she was posed
from
that question...
From the 3 year ago thing.
Correct. Not from the 3 year ago thing. It was...
Concerned that he would leave her as a response to this event.
Current,
okay.
Yes. Was that, yes, she was afraid. Were you afraid of your husband leaving you when you told him? And this is at Joint Appendix 235. Alleged victim said, yes, I was. Further on, there's a question by the military judge, kind of asking her, strike that. So that's the response.
Counsel, is it necessary for the defense to present any evidence in that regard? That is, the evidence may be helpful. But suppose that the accuser denied that it would have any effect on the marriage. Wouldn't the defense still be able to argue that there was a motive to lie given the nature of marriage and the effect of any kind of extramarital affair on the marriage?
The defense could still argue that.
Wouldn't that always be relevant in any case in which the accuser is claiming rape and the defendant is claiming consensual activity, that there would be a motive to lie if third parties have observed activity which they could perceive as consensual and report it back to a spouse?
Sir, are you referring to the windfall, or not the windfall, but too broad of a ruling allowing any extramarital affairs?
I'm just asking the question. In any case in which third parties have observed sexual activity and could possibly report it back to a spouse, wouldn't the defense always be able to contend that there was a motive to lie and examine evidence on that basis as being relevant without actually having to introduce any particular evidence in the case, just by those circumstances themselves, and attempt to persuade the fact finder that there was a motive to lie because the spouse would have found out about an activity observed by third parties which could have been perceived as consensual, and that would then have an impact on the marriage?
That is strong motive to fabricate evidence, absolutely, and it's a point that the Army Court made in its decision, suggesting that that was the best evidence that the accused could bring forth with regard to her motive to fabricate. However, the best evidence in this case was that evidence plus the extramarital affair and the reaction to it combined. It made it that much stronger. That was the best evidence that the accused in this case could bring forth with regard to her motive to fabricate.
Now, in terms of the question of the word vital in Banker, I understand your argument. Assuming that we do not change Banker in any manner in the opinion in this case, is that necessary for you to prevail in this case?
It is not, Your Honor. Even if the vitality, if you will, of the evidence is required, in this case the evidence was absolutely vital. When you consider the strength of the government's case versus the significance of that particular testimony or evidence of her motive to fabricate, it's clear that it was vital to his defense. Add a moment, please. I'll rest on that answer.
Thank you.
Are you arguing, is it your position that 412 is unconstitutional, that, are you arguing 412 is unconstitutional as written or as interpreted in Banker?
As interpreted by Banker.
Okay.
Because the word vital is not in the rule, whereas it is a requirement established
by Banker. It's Banker that you accept to.
Correct, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Focusing on just bringing the court's attention to the judge's findings in this case, they were purely erroneous in several respects. All the more reason that the Army Court, unfortunately, which adopted those findings, should not have based its decision. Importantly, as has happened both at the trial level and by the Army Court, there's a misconstruction of the defense counsel's theory of relevance. It wasn't that the alleged victim was concerned about harm, physical harm by her husband. It wasn't that she was afraid that her extramarital affair wouldn't be protected, because we all know that her extramarital affair occurred 2.5 years ago. It was to protect her current existing marriage, which importantly, there's indicia from the words of the alleged victim herself that she, again, she was afraid her husband would leave her. There's indicia that there was trouble created as a result of that extramarital affair from 2.5 years ago. She indicated at Joint Appendix 2, page 38, we worked everything out fairly quickly. There was something to be worked out. There were troubles created by the extramarital affair. The husband testifies at the motion hearing at Joint Appendix 2, 46 and 47 that his wife moved in with her parents after the affair. The parents had to pick her up from where she had been living. He also testified that the discussion with the parents occurred at their home because, quote unquote, the complications and problems happened in late December. Both of them made clear that there were problems as a result.
Well, but wasn't there also testimony that the marriage was, quote, stronger than ever?
Suggesting that there was something that had to be,
something that had to be strengthened, but had been strengthened. So where does that leave you?
It leaves us still with the fact that that extramarital affair had occurred, had created problems in the marriage. The second extramarital affair could have been that much worse for the marriage. In addition to making that erroneous finding, the military judge found that the only evidence that the husband would leave the alleged victim in the marriage or react in any other way was the husband kicking down the door and the fact that he had spent 3 days in jail. In response to the military judge's own question to the husband, he was asked whether he had told anyone what he would do if his wife had an affair. He stated, not to my knowledge, but a lot of people know that I'm hot-tempered. The fact that it was unknown what he would do in the face of another affair, in the eyes of his wife, who had this motive to fabricate, is important. She didn't know how he would react. There was no resolution between the parties that their marriage would continue forever, despite what happened to it. In addition, the military judge essentially adopted the government's argument that to allow evidence of the alleged victim's previous extramarital affair would mean that any time a married woman alleges rape, her complete sexual history during the marriage becomes relevant to show bias. What's important in this case is we don't have just an extramarital affair, we have the husband's volatile emotional response to that affair.
Counsel, in terms of your characterization of your position with respect to 412 vis-a-vis Banker, rather than the word vital, what word would you use as synonymous with favorable?
Favorable.
Because this goes back, I think, to Judge Baker's earlier questions, which is if it's relevant and material, when would you be offering it if you didn't think it was favorable?
That's correct. I appreciate that question, Your Honor, to the extent that the evidence is offered because it's assumed that it is favorable evidence. So it begs the question as to whether any term necessarily has to be assigned to the balancing test that ultimately is done.
But then doesn't that change your answer to Judge Baker's question? I mean, isn't then it, is, as long as it's relevant and material, it is a full stop?
It's not a full stop because you still have to consider the privacy interest of the alleged victim in the case. You still have to engage in that balancing test.
The 412 also talks about probative nature, right? So you're reading that out of 412. So you're saying 412 is itself unconstitutional.
No, it needs to be, correct, it needs to be relevant and probative. So you're asking
so you,
what...
So you view the balancing, to determine whether to balance probosity, you just say if it's material, it passes the probosity test.
It's all about weighing the strength of that evidence versus the privacy.
But you're not weighing the strength of that evidence and the importance of that evidence. If you say once it's material, it's in, and all we do now is look to the privacy interest. Is the judge not supposed to see whether what it tells you about this case? If it's material, it's in. I think Judge Ryan and I are trying to ask the same question, which is, what's the more here? And you're saying the only thing that's more is you do something with the privacy, but I don't see how the privacy changes anything if you've already said it's in, if it's material.
Your Honor, if I may, I'd like to give a more coherent answer on rebuttal.
You're welcome to, yeah. Done without prejudice to seeing that you had an incoherent answer.
Correct, Your Honor. In the least, in this case, the military judge, if I can go back to the issue one in this case, the military judge should have afforded the appellant the ability to ask two very straightforward questions that were not embarrassing, harassing, would cause confusion to the jury, or the panel rather. And those two questions are, did you previously have an extramarital affair on your husband to whom you are still married? And isn't your husband hot-tempered? Those are the only two questions that would have allowed this motive to fabricate to at least have been put forth to the panel.
Counsel, you'll have a further opportunity on rebuttal unless there's a particular point you'd like to make
right
now.
No, thank you, Your Honor. I see my time is running well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Counsel. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge Efron. May it please the Court. My name is Captain Frank Kostick, and along with Major LeJean White, we represent the United States in this matter. The military judge did not abuse her discretion, excluding a remote and factually incongruent affair of the victim. Furthermore, Military Rule of Evidence 412C3 balancing test, as articulated by United States v. Banker, does not create a presumption that constitutionally required evidence is inadmissible, but rather creates a framework to determine if the evidence offered is favorable and thus constitutionally required. The military judge in this case conducted a closed 412 hearing as required by the rule when considering the evidence of a prior extramarital affair. In so doing, she heard evidence from the defense, government, and argument, and she applied the framework as articulated by United States v. Banker and issued a ruling both verbally on the record and later in writing. In doing so, she applied MRA 401 as required by the rule to determine whether the evidence was relevant. She determined that it was not relevant.
Isn't the real problem with proffered evidence like this not that it's not relevant in the 401 sense, but that it's entirely too relevant, that we keep it out because it's so relevant and it has such an effect on the members that it's thought as a matter of public policy better to place rather significant limitations on it? Isn't that the real problem?
I agree, Your Honor. That is the real problem. And through a legislative determination, Congress has determined that this type of evidence...
Well, I'm not talking about the power of Congress to make that determination. I'm talking about legal relevance. You know, we're throwing around the term relevance here. Isn't the real problem that in many, many cases it's way too relevant?
In some cases, I would agree with Your Honor that it would be way too relevant. Yeah. However, in this particular case, a three-year...
Is the government's position that it's too relevant?
It is not the government's position.
Okay, what is the government's position?
Our position that a three-year extramarital, a three-year in the past extramarital affair is not relevant to whether...
Because of the lapse in time? Solely because of the lapse in time?
Not solely because of lapse in time, but lapse in time is an important factor, as noted by this court, United States v. Smith. In addition to why it's not relevant, contrary to the affair, the couple did remain married. They did have a child after the affair. They believed that their relationship got stronger. And the government's
position... So if they had another affair, it would get even stronger. Is that the government's position?
Of course, that is not the position. However...
Then what is the position as to why a prior incident of that nature couldn't, of its own independent weight, have a significant impact on how the jury now viewed an incident which is described by the Court of Criminal Appeals as third parties hearing sexual noises coming from a room and then opening the door of the room and observing sexual activity between the accuser and the accused in that room? Why wouldn't a prior incident be something that the court, the fact finders, would find of significance in weighing the impact of the current incident? Or does the government take the view that the current incident created no motive to lie either?
We don't believe the current incident created a motive to lie, but...
Oh, so it's your view that when a spouse is observed by third parties engaging in sexual activity with a person that's not her husband, that person has no motive to lie as to whether the incident was consensual or non-consensual.
Under the facts of this case, Your Honor, when she was observed, she was being raped and she was passed out. And the testimony of the record establishes that when the lights came on, she had no reaction.
Did the third parties see that it was rape and that she was passed out? Which one of them testified to that effect? That's not what the Court of Criminal Appeals said on page 2 of its opinion.
The joint appendix establishes that, one, Ms. Paige Van Treese, she testified that the victim, one, drank alcohol, two, took Xanax, and was passed out earlier in the evening. She also saw appellant on top of the victim and noted the victim had no response when she flicked on the lights and opened the door. It's a reasonable inference to that point that at least Ms. Paige Van Treese believed that she was not a willing participant in that sexual.
Did Ms. Van Treese testify that, in her view, she was not a willing participant?
She did not testify.
Then wasn't that a decision for the fact finder to make in this case?
Certainly.
Thank you.
To go back to the
question is not whether the appellant had the right to put on evidence relating to a motive to fabricate. Clearly he did. The question is whether this particular evidence was constitutionally required to be admitted when it also implicated Rule 412 and was propensity, could be used as propensity to engage in sex. So don't get sidetracked on whether there's a motive to fabricate issue. The question is what evidence can be brought in to demonstrate that or not. In this case, is it your view, what is the theory upon which the defense was operating in the government's view? Reaction, consent, what specific theory do you believe the appellant was bringing this in for?
As they stated, they were bringing it in for a motive to fabricate, and as they argued in their brief, that the critical evidence lost from the previous affair was the husband's violent reaction. I think, Your Honor, your question and Judge Efron's question are important because we have to look to the victim's mind at the time that she allegedly had this motive to fabricate. And as this court noted in Dorsey, and they went into some extent to talk about what it means for someone to have a motive. And so at the time that she was raped, she would have had to think back, harken back to her affair and say, based on my experience with my husband during that affair, I now must claim that I was raped in order to avoid that violent reaction. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your perspective, the appellant in this case was unable to articulate that at the time of trial. And because they were unable to articulate that at the time of trial, they did not establish the Sixth Amendment right to present that evidence to the panel, to get back to what evidence would be relevant for the panel to hear. So, again, it's the government's position.
Is that a waiver theory, then, in a sense that, in your view, the defense, by the manner in which it raised the issue, did not provide sufficient articulation of the impact of the prior incident on a motive to lie?
It is not a waiver issue in the government's view. What it is a standard of review issue. I mean, this court is looking at whether the military judge abused her discretion. Mm-hmm. And so the only way that we can determine whether the military judge abused her discretion is looked at the evidence that was presented before her. As this court noted in Banker, they have to look to the evidence that was presented before the military judge, not to the evidence that or a different way to articulate.
I'm not clear on your point, then. Is it the evidence or the argument that was made? That is, is it your view that the defense failed to provide evidence that would be relevant and meet the other standards for constitutional admission, or is that the defense failed to make an argument that made the tie so apparent to the judge that the judge would have abused the discretion?
It's both, Your Honor. They both failed to present the evidence that would basically give them an argument to connect the two. Because they failed to present the evidence, they had no argument to connect the previous stale affair with the current, with their alleged current motive to fabricate. So the military judge couldn't have on her own said, well, defense, I hear your argument. However, I still find, based on the evidence, that you've made the connection. So she did not abuse her discretion.
Counsel, I don't understand. In your brief, you argue that if this evidence were admissible, then any time a woman is raped, her sexual history would be relevant because she might be lying.
Right.
Why is that? Why does this case equal that?
It appears to the government that the appellant was arguing, at least in part in their brief, that one affair equals, well, let me rephrase that. If you have one affair and your relationship remains strong, that a second affair will always equal a divorce. And so anytime someone has a second affair in a marriage.
So you don't mean anytime a woman is raped. You mean anytime a woman is raped where the context might be a second affair.
As the appellant would argue. So in this particular case.
Your statement is a wee bit broader than that. It was any case, as I read it. But you're not arguing, are you arguing a case like this then?
Well, a case like this, but it is broader than a case like this. I mean, in essence, if you follow the appellant's argument, any time there is a rape in a marriage in which there was a previous extramarital affair, the extramarital affair would per se come in because the second rape could lead to.
You've answered my question because you've brought some more facts into the statement. Thank you.
Counsel, I'm not clear on that point. Irrespective of what the defense may have said in their brief, their characterization, if there is an incident which could reasonably be perceived by a third party as a consensual affair, consensual sexual activity. Is it the government's position that you have to look at the strength of the marriage to determine whether there's a motive to lie, or is that a question for the fact finder to determine based upon the incident itself? In other words, can the judge say, oh, well, the fact that someone may have perceived this as consensual, that's not good enough for me. I'm not going to allow any questions about motive to lie unless you show me something about the marriage itself.
No, if I understand your question,
we're not talking about the past event. We're just talking about the present event, whether there's a motive to lie.
As sort of a preliminary matter, you do not have to look to whether the marriage is strong in any case to determine whether there's a motive to lie. But what the government's position would be that you do have to conduct is some sort of analysis to determine, well, what is that motive and why would that be in the mind of the victim at the time of her statement or her allegation of rape? So as a preliminary matter, you must say, well, was there a previous affair and was that...
Let's take a case where there's no previous affair. A third party sees an event which the members could determine to be consensual or non-consensual, and the third party doesn't opine as to whether it's consensual or not. In that situation, what more does the defense need to show in order to explore the question of whether that event itself creates a motive to lie in the midst of a marriage?
And again, Your Honor, I don't think under your facts that we would even be in MRE 412 because there would be no prior sex.
That's
act.
Right.
However,
so then in that sense, it is relevant to a motive to lie, the act itself.
The act itself, and they did exploit the act itself here. I mean, the defense in this case was permitted to exploit the act itself in a variety of different ways.
Now, what if there's a prior incident that doesn't involve an act of sex, but it does involve a person giving strong attention to a spouse? And the accused in that, the person who's the accuser, and the spouse of the accuser gets very angry at that situation and shows that anger, knocks down the door of the third party, etc. Would that be relevant? Could the defense explore that to show that you have a hot-headed spouse and therefore that might give the person an even stronger motive to lie?
Under the facts that you've given me, that sounds very similar to Olden v. Kentucky, and I would argue that the jealousy and anger being ongoing at the time of the alleged rape would likely be relevant, at least under the holding in Olden v. Kentucky.
Let's say that it's not even ongoing. You have an incident from the past, and there's no further evidence. There's just the incident from the past that shows that this person could react to unwanted attention to a spouse in an angry manner.
I would argue that the length in time is an important okay. factor. So the farther you get away from the event is important. And two, the defense must have some showing, at least during the 412 hearing or during some preliminary matter, that previous reaction of the spouse was on the mind of the victim at the time that she made the allegation. So you have to connect the two. And again, in this case, that is what the... what the appellant is
doing. If the victim denies that it was on her mind, does that preclude the defense from arguing to the fact finder? You, the fact finder, have to determine whether that's credible or not.
If the victim denies that was on her mind, but the other facts in the record establish that maybe it was, for example, you could look to maybe a conversation that the victim had weeks prior where she talked about the affair or how her husband's reaction to the affair. So I think you can look outside of what the victim
I understand your position. Thank you.
Your Honor, moving to the second issue in this particular case, like statutes, military rules of evidence are to be construed fairly possible to avoid the conclusion that they're unconstitutional.
Do we need to decide the second issue to decide this case?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And so once we start with that basic premise that if there are multiple ways to view a statute or a military rule of evidence, and one of those ways is constitutional, this court should decide it in such a way as constitutional. But the government's position is, even as this court articulated the analysis of the United States v. Banker, it does not create an unconstitutional presumption. The government respectfully disagrees with the appellant's interpretation of Valenzuela-Bernal in so that the evidence must be relevant, material, and vital. That to say that evidence is relevant and material equals vital sort of suggests the conceivable benefit test that court, in fact, rejected. So if you can establish that something is relevant and material, it must be vital. And the court in Valenzuela-Bernal uses the conjunctive word and. You know, it must be relative, material, and vital to establish that Sixth Amendment right. And so, as this court articulated in the United States v. Banker, Where do we determine whether something is vital? We look at whether something is vital within the confines of the balancing test. So is it favorable? Is it vital to the defense? And that's a very useful exercise for the military judge to determine what exactly is the appellant proffering at the trial level.
Well, now you're getting the balancing test. I'll ask you the same thing I asked the appellant, which is in a case like this where the prosecutrix has, if not blabbed about this all over the place, made no secret of it. Doesn't that substantially attenuate any privacy interest, and shouldn't that affect the balancing test?
It should affect the balancing test. However, the government would disagree that she blabbed.
She owned up to it. Doesn't the record reflect that she owned up to it and said she wasn't ashamed of it?
Certainly. And as we stated prior, or in our brief, it's a very different thing to talk about an extramarital affair with your family and close friends than it is to talk about an extramarital affair in open court in front of complete strangers.
Well, I might say, which way does that cut? Shouldn't one be more likely to not want to talk about something like this with close friends than with a bunch of people you don't know? I mean, which way does that cut?
Well, certainly in this particular case, this victim had no issue talking about it with her family and close friends. However, when the military judge asked her point blank, do you want me to, you know, would you be embarrassed if this were disclosed in open court? She said, certainly.
Well, in view of what she'd already done, doesn't that go to the weight of that assertion?
I'm not falling in view of what she...
Never mind.
Counselor, go ahead.
Go ahead.
So I understand your position. It's that we never get to the balancing test because the evidence, given its remoteness in the government's view, wasn't vital, and therefore you don't even balance the privacy interests here. Is that your view here?
That is, Your Honor. In fact, the military judge went well beyond what she needed to do because under the analytical framework of 412, once she determined that the evidence wasn't relevant, she needed not go further. But in this case, she did go through the entire analysis, including the 403 analysis, and determined that the evidence would likely confuse the issues, and she excluded under 403 as well.
You're not suggesting, though, that the privacy interest is met anytime the victim says it should be embarrassed by something being talked about in open court? Because that's not the government's position, is it?
Certainly not. It's just, Your Honor, it's just one factor for the court to consider with the, I see that my time has expired.
You can answer the question. You'll have, if you have another point you want to make, and then conclude, that will be fine.
Certainly it's just a factor for the court to consider, as well as other factors. And I agree with Judge Stuckey that you could in fact consider that she has talked to her family and friends about this, and the military judge has the ability to weigh how she believes that should cut when engaging in that balancing. And in fact, in this particular case, the military judge presented with a range of choices. Certainly, this was one well within her range of choices, therefore, should not abuse her discretion. As I can briefly conclude, military rule of evidence 412C3 balancing test does not create that unconstitutional burden that is argued by the appellant. In this case, the military judge, again, did not abuse her discretion because she properly excluded the proffered evidence as not relevant under 401. In addition to unduly prejudicial under 403 and MRE 412, that this court should affirm the finding of the sentence.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Your Honor, in response to your question about if it's not vital, what is it? If it's not just relevant and material. To the extent I can answer that question in two ways, shed some light on my response. In this case, the evidence was vital because the military judge's ruling excluded the best evidence and motive to fabricate. Despite the military judge's ruling, defense counsel had attempted to elicit evidence supporting motive to fabricate and argued as much as he could at closing, but he was hamstrung by the military judge's ruling. And it was vital to the defense theory in the context of all evidence presented at trial. Second portion of the response, Your Honor, is that the Powell and pumpkin seed cases cited to in our brief suggest that there's some sort of 403 consideration as part of the relevancy portion of the analysis. So to the extent you look at the totality of the case, the strength of the evidence presented in relation to the relative strength of the privacy interest.
You favor that.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You seem to favor that in your brief.
Favor how it's done in outside of the military justice system.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you would have no problem with the pumpkin seed test that you quote, which is the exclusion of the evidence must not be arbitrary or disproportionate to the purposes that its exclusion was designed to serve.
Absolutely.
You have no problem with that.
That's correct, Your Honor. Absolutely, because it allows for a sliding scale, if you will, to look at the evidence actually presented at trial and say not just it has to be vital in all cases, but if the government's case is particularly weak.
And then your argument would be you're contesting whether 412 accomplishes the same end or not.
Correct, Your Honor.
And then to what extent is in the 412 balancing context? Is the husband's view about privacy relevant? Or the husband's view, period, about anything?
That, because 412 is meant to protect the privacy interest of the alleged victim, appellant maintains that that doesn't have any weighing. It doesn't weigh at all on the analysis.
Under 403, 412, or any other balancing test. So the judge, it's precluded from the judge's consideration or just not the core interest?
It's not the core interest, Your Honor. It could be a consideration to the extent
it's not the core 412 interest, but
that's correct,
is it an appropriate factor to weigh at some level?
You suggested a military rule of evidence 403. And I don't know if that would go to the factor of harassment or... I don't have a better answer other than to say that 412 is geared towards the alleged victim protection of
her. On the table.
But in a motive to lie situation, couldn't the husband's views be very significant in the balancing test when the military judge is trying to determine whether or not there was a motive to lie and how important the evidence was, whether it's material, vital, or any other standard? That is, if the husband is in the type of relationship where the existence of another event wouldn't be a particular matter of concern, would the judge be well within the judge's grounds taking that into account and deciding that the evidence wasn't even material, much less vital?
Again, I don't agree with that, Your Honor, because MRE 412 is, you're saying in any context, even
I'm talking about the motive to lie, where 412 is coming up in a motive to lie situation. If the husband's testimony would significantly undercut the motive to lie, why shouldn't the judge take that into account in both the relevancy and materiality determination and in the balancing test determination?
He should, but to the extent that is an issue for the panel, and I think that's what you're driving at, sir, is it really...
I'm just asking for your answer.
Is it for the military judge to really decide the weight of that evidence or whether it's... or whether it's for the fact finder? I maintain that it's for the fact finder to ultimately determine whether or not that undercuts the motive to fabricate.
Okay. And how would you address the government's position that the defense at the trial did not articulate the theory that's now being argued on appeal, and therefore the judge didn't abuse her discretion because she didn't have that theory before her?
The theory was absolutely presented to the military judge at the time.
What part of the record do you want to point to for us to focus on for that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Joint Appendix 2 at pages 54 to 56. Importantly, and this is in reference to the Army Court's decision on that particular issue, it seems to be that the military judge only focused on aspects of the government's argument, not everything that the defense argued in support of that theory of relevance.
That answers my question, unless there's a further question from the bench.
If there are no further questions, I'd like to briefly conclude. As a result of the military judge's abuse of discretion in violation, as a result of her abuse of discretion in excluding the evidence that was proffered by the defense in this case, we ask that the findings for specification, additional specification one, be set aside. And with regard to the constitutionality issue, particularly because of the unconstitutional application of Banker in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. My question may have gone a bit beyond the scope of the government's counsel's argument. Did the government counsel have anything else it wanted to point to in the record for us to look at as to the scope of defense counsel's argument, or will you rest on your brief on that? Thank you. Parties have now made the submission. Thank you very much for your presentation today, and the court will be in recess until 10:20 a.m.
The court stands in recess until 10:20 a.m.